There are more than 3,400 species of snakes in the world. And these cold-blooded creatures can be found slithering around on every continent in the world except Antarctica. And no, Diana, we are not pricing real estate in Antarctica. I suspect if most people were asked what is the worst of these 3,400 species, most would probably answer the king cobra, but most would be wrong. The king cobra does make the top 10 list of worst venomous snakes, but just barely, coming in at number 10. Number 3 is the inland taipan, a snake with venom so powerful, just a 100 milligram dose is enough to kill 100 human beings. And they can inject up to 100 milligrams per bite. Number 2 is the mainland tiger snake, a snake whose venom, when injected, affects the nervous system, blood clotting proteins, and muscles. That does not sound fun. Then there is the number 1 most dangerous snake in the world, the eastern brown snake, a snake responsible for the most fatalities in Australia, where there are a lot of snakes. Now, when it comes to Canada, you will be happy to know that the situation is not near as bad. There is only roughly 26 species of snakes here in Canada, and not even a quarter of them are venomous. You see, snakes prefer a warmer climate. So when our winters get a bit longer, just be grateful, because that means less snakes here in Atlantic Canada. Now, there are a few venomous snakes in Canada, like the desert night snake, the prairie rattlesnake, and the Massasauga. This is a venomous snake found in the Georgian Bay in Ontario, whose bites can be fatal. Now, to be sure, not all snakes are venomous. In fact, less than 10% of the 3,400 species are venomous. Furthermore, and I mean, come on, it's not so bad. Furthermore, only 60% of snake bites on humans result in venom being injected, which means that the other 40%, they're just dry bites. I mean, you're just getting bit by a snake. What's the big deal, really, right? Regardless of whether a snake is venomous or not, and regardless of how many species of snakes there are in any given country, and regardless of whether a snake's bite is venomous or dry, I think, as I mentioned last week, it is understandable that most people are not especially fond of snakes. Also, as noted last week, I think in light of what we know about snakes, we shouldn't be at all surprised that when an animal who seeks the harm of God's first created beings comes at them in the Garden of Eden, it is a snake, a serpent. And to be sure, John confirms that the snake was more than just a snake when he says, when he sees a day when the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan. You see, since that day in the Garden of Eden, there has been a battle at play in this world, a war between the serpent and the God who created and sustains all things. Again, as mentioned last week, this fight is not a fair fight because Satan literally does not have a single chance at victory, not one, and he never did, which means that though we need to be aware of the serpent and his tactics, we don't need to be afraid of him. God has all power in and of himself, and thus it is not possible for God to not get what he wants, which means it is literally impossible for God to lose, literally impossible. With all of that in mind, I can't think of a reason why anyone would want to be on the side of the serpent, living like Satan, like Saul was. Saul was a snake on the throne, so to speak. Why would you want that when you could instead be on God's side, like David was? Now, in last week's text, as I mentioned, there was a snake on the throne of Israel. And likewise, in this week's text, that snake is still on that throne, and that is a problem. But if you recall, the focus of last week's text was on that snake. We focused in on Saul and his repeated efforts to kill David, while this week's text focuses in on David and Saul's repeated failure to kill him. So the focus this morning is David, the one who was anointed by God, and the one who trusted in God, and the one who was faithful to God in whatever circumstance he found himself in, and the one who, as we will see in our text, which is 1 Samuel 19, will successfully escape the ongoing attack from the snake on the throne. So while last week's focus was on the one making the attacks, the focus this week is the one on whom the attacks are being made. And what must not be missed is that the reason that David successfully escapes the snake on the throne again and again is that God has a plan for David, and God's plans are always accomplished, which means that in the end, Satan's attacks will all ultimately fail because God always gets what he wants. God always wins. And if you are on his side, which is to say you love God and you are called according to God's purposes, then all things work together for your good. No matter the circumstances, no matter how it looks from your perspective, no matter how dire things may get, if you are on God's side, which is to say you trust in him and you want to be faithful to him, then the message today is quite simply that you must cling to the promise that because you are on God's side, things will work out for your good. Maybe not now, but in the end. Maybe not here, but there. If you belong to God, his plan for you will come to pass, because for you, all things work together for good. Let's look at 1 Samuel chapter 19. 1 Samuel chapter 19. This is the word of the Lord. And as we read, as I read, listen and look for where the snake attacks and David escapes. 1 Samuel 19. And Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, "Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore be on your guard in the morning. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are. And I will speak to my father about you. And if I learn anything, I will tell you." And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took his life in his hand, and he struck down the Philistine, and the Lord, that's Yahweh, worked a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause?" And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. Saul swore, "As Yahweh lives, he shall not be put to death." And Jonathan called David. Jonathan reported to him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. And there was war again. And David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a great blow, so that they fled, before him. Then a harmful spirit from Yahweh came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. And David was playing the lyre. And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he eluded Saul so that he struck the spear into the wall. And David fled and escaped that night. Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him, that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, "If you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let David down through the window, and he fled away and escaped. Michal took an image and laid it on the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair at its head and covered it with the clothes. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He is sick." Then Saul sent the messengers to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him." And when the messengers came in, behold, the image was in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair at its head. Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me thus and let my enemy go so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?' Now David fled and escaped. And he came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and lived at Naoth. And it was told Saul, 'Behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah.' Then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying and Samuel standing his head over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah and came to the great well that is in Shechem. And he asked, 'Where are Samuel and David?' And one said, 'Behold, they are at Naoth in Ramah.' And he went there to Naoth in Ramah. And the Spirit of God came upon him also. And as he went, he prophesied until he came to Naoth in Ramah. And he too stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel, and lay naked all that day and all that night. Thus it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? So, no gore in this week's text, you'll be happy to know, but definitely some comedy for sure. Last week, we read of Saul's desire to see David dead as the current king of Israel tried three different ways to kill the future king of Israel. So first he tries the direct approach, he throws the spear at David not once but twice, and he misses. Then he tried to use a lie to get David killed, promising him his daughter Merab, which would lead to him being on the battlefield more, where he was more likely to be killed than if he were in the palace playing the lyre. Finally, after reneging on his promise to give Merab to David, Saul offers David another daughter, Michal, and he named a very odd bride price, one which he hoped would get David killed as he went to collect that bride price. Saul was not successful in any of his attempts, because he was working for the serpent. He was working for Satan. And because God had anointed David to be king, Saul would not be successful. Now today, as we go on to chapter 19, we really see very much of the same. We continue to see Saul seeking the death of David. But the narrator here focuses more in on David here. And if you notice, we repeatedly heard the words that he escaped. He fled and he escaped. More attempts on his life from Saul, the snake on the throne. So then today, David, the next king of Israel, goes on the run as he escapes the murderous attentions of Saul, as he is helped by his friend and by his wife and by Samuel the prophet. So let's get into this morning. Our text begins with Saul sharing his murderous intentions with his staff, which included his son and all his servants, which means thus far, only Saul and David, and maybe if there were some people in the room when he tried to kill him last time, knew about his intent to kill David. It had not gotten spread around. But now Saul figures if there's more people involved in this attempt to kill David, there's a better chance that David will be killed. And so he says to Jonathan and all his servants, "We need to kill David." Now, there was one problem with this, and that is, while Jonathan was Saul's son, Jonathan was also David's best friend. And he was not prepared to sit idly by while his father sought to kill his friend. And so, what Jonathan does is he does basically two things. First of all, he goes right to David, and he tells David about his father's intents. And then he says, this is what we're going to do. You go to this field and hide yourself, and I'm going to come along with my father, and I'm going to talk to my father about you, and you will then be able to overhear some of it. It seems as though he doesn't overhear all of it, but this is what is about to happen. And when he brings his father to have this chat that David is supposed to supposedly overhear, eavesdrop into, there are three things which he is going to say to his father that should hopefully get him to reconsider his desire to kill David. And these are the three things. The first that Jonathan says to his David is that it would be a sin for Saul to kill David, which is the best reason for Saul to not carry out his murderous intent. Don't do that. Why shouldn't I do it? Because it's a sin to do it. It's a sin against the holy God. That's the best reason. But the second reason is that David has not sinned against Saul. So if David hasn't sinned against you, why would you sin in return? Not as though Jonathan's attempting to say it's okay to sin against a person if they sin against you, but it's like he's not done anything to you. Why would you do anything to him? And the third is that on the flip side of that, David has in fact given Saul good reasons to not kill him. In particular, he just killed Goliath, and this was the most significant thing. So Jonathan, that's his defense against his father killing David. And then finally, he reminds Saul at the end of this in the second half of verse 5, look, you were happy with David when David killed Goliath. And David has given you no reasons to not be happy with him anymore, so why should you not be happy with him? Now, what happens next is not what we should expect. If we've been paying attention in the first 18 chapters of 1 Samuel, in particular the last several, We should be very surprised when Saul here listens to reason from his son and decides to not kill David. Furthermore, he swears an oath before God, which was permitted in the Old Testament, but he didn't have to do this. But no, he swears an oath before God that David will not be killed. And so Jonathan goes and gets David, and David is welcomed back into the kingdom as a lyre player and a soldier. Now, I want to take a break for a moment here from the narrative, and I want to make an application. And this application, it's not the main application. I'm going to get to the main application in a little while. But I think there is an application to make here. If you recall, Saul and Jonathan have been contrasted before. And I think that there is another contrast here. Once again, Saul is not the good example here. Jonathan is the good example. And I think there's something that we ought to learn from Jonathan. And it concerns his willingness to speak the truth, especially concerning matters of righteousness. I think that's an application that we need in this day and age, and maybe especially that we need in this month. And that is that we must be willing to speak the truth, especially concerning righteousness, even if it puts our lives or our reputations at risk. We must acknowledge that it would have been much easier for Jonathan to have remained silent in Saul's presence, wouldn't it have? I mean, he even could have just remained silent and then attempted to help David behind the scenes. But no, he is willing to stand up to his father and call out the unrighteousness of his king. And he does this, first of all, of course, because he cares about David and he wants David to live and succeed. But he also does this because he cares about his father doing the right thing. I mean, we see this when he tells them it would be a sin. And Jonathan doesn't want his father to sin. And thirdly, he does this because he cares about God's glory. And he knows that sins against God do not glorify God. And he doesn't want Saul to do this. So my point here is if we care about others, we must be willing to speak the truth. And surely, we must all acknowledge that in this day and age, and concerning the matters that are celebrated this month and really every month of the year, we are told repeatedly that to speak the truth is hateful. We see people losing their jobs because they tell the truth. We see baseball players losing their jobs because they speak the truth. We are told that we are hateful bigots because we speak the truth. But as people of God, like Jonathan, if we care about others, and if we care about the glory of God, which is to say we seek to love God and our neighbor, we too must be willing to speak the truth, especially when it concerns righteousness. Even if it will make us unpopular, we'll lose friends, even when it means people will hate us for it and call us names and slander us, maybe even when it means our lives will be in danger. Our God is the God of truth and God of righteousness. And so an attack against truth is an attack against God. So if we want God to be glorified, we must stand up for the truth and speak out, especially when it concerns righteousness. That's what Jonathan did. So getting back to our narrative, Saul has declared before God and himself that he would stop his pursuit of David's death. That, I think, should surprise us all. What happens next shouldn't surprise us one little bit. It all begins when war breaks out between Israel and the Philistines once again, and David is needed in the battlefield, and once again he succeeds. And once again a spirit from God comes to torment Saul, and once again David is called in to play his lyre. And once again, as the last time, his melodies do not do what Saul hoped they would do. Saul is once again holding his spear. That should always cue us off. Something's going to happen. He's holding his spear, and so he again throws it at David. This will be the third time. David escapes Saul's sword again. We've got to assume that David's a little bit on his toes right now. He's had Saul's spear thrown at him twice already. I'm sure he's not going to be surprised it happens a third time. And so it does happen a third time, and he escapes Saul's sword again. And this time doesn't hang around for Saul to have another chance. Instead, as the narrator tells us, David fled and escaped that night. This then is the beginning of David's life as a fugitive, and David will remain a fugitive for some time. The future king of Israel is now on the run. But for now, he's not hard to find, because guess where he goes when he leaves the palace? He goes home. So not really hard to find him. So he goes home to his wife, and Saul sends men to David's house to wait outside for him, supposedly, until he leaves in the morning, and then they are to kill David. Now, Michal, his wife, has a better plan. Her plan is for David to escape. So she lowers him out a window in the back of the house. And again, the narrator tells us a second time, David fled away and escaped. Now, Michal has not done seeking to keep her husband alive. So she tries to buy some time, basically by pulling a Ferris Bueller. And if you don't know what that is, it's all right. She takes an image, which is a life-sized idol, and she puts David's pajamas on it, and she puts some goat hair on top, and she tucks it under the covers of David's bed. So when the men come in looking for David, she tells them that he is sick, but we have to infer that she brought them to his room, opened the door, She opens the door, and they look in, and they see this thing, and David's pajamas, I guess David's hair looks like goat hair, and she says, look, he's sick. He's in bed. We mustn't disturb him. So they go back to the palace, and they tell Saul, look, man, David's sick. Like, what are we going to do? And Saul says, I'll tell you what you do. You go back there, you pick him up, bed and all, and you bring him back here. I'm going to kill him. Okay, so they go back, and they go to get David on his bed, and of course, Michal's ruse is discovered, because they find it's just this life-size idol with goat's hair and David's pajamas. So Saul is not happy about this. He asks his daughter, why have you done this? Why have you protected my enemy? Not to mention that he is her husband. And she tells a lie. She says, David threatened to kill me if I didn't let him go. Seems like the apple doesn't fall far from the tree when it comes to Michal. Clearly, she learned all about lying and deception from her father. Now, again, I want to take a moment, step back from our text. We will return to the main application in a few minutes, but I want to consider something here, sort of like another bonus application, like with Jonathan. This time it concerns Michal, who had good intentions with bad actions. She had good intentions with bad actions. You see, she was trying to protect her husband, the future king of Israel, which is good, but she used deception and lies to do it, and that is bad. Now, I'm going to share something with you. I'm not afraid to tell you that some theologians disagree with me on this point. One, in fact, says, and I quote, it is again noteworthy that Michal lied in order to protect David. This was no sin, but an act of loyalty to Yahweh and his future king. Now, you need to know, I take great exception to that quote. I really don't think God has left this up for debate. I mean, I just finished telling you that Jonathan put his life on the line to speak the truth, and I encourage us to do likewise. How can I then come in here and let Michal's lies slip? Now, I just don't see how I can. Now, there are other theologians. One of them, probably my favorite theologian, he was not on the planet anymore, but who thinks that it's okay to lie in some circumstances, but I just can't get my head around it. Now, some commenting on this text will say something like this. They'll say that the narrator who wrote 1 Samuel mentions Michal and her lie, but doesn't comment on the morality of the lie. Several commentators will say that the narrator doesn't give commentary on the morality or lack thereof here, which that's true. But to say that he doesn't make comment on morality is to suggest that, you know, maybe it was okay. Like, he doesn't say whether it was okay or it wasn't okay. Now, again, I acknowledge that the narrator doesn't make comment on the morality or lack thereof, but I think the reason he doesn't is because he doesn't have to. When you have the Ten Commandments, which they did, and the ninth one says you shall not bear false witness, which it does, why does the narrator have to say that her sin was a lie? Her lie was a sin. We already know that her lie was a sin. And I think we know that with certainty. Lying is explicitly condemned in Scripture. So nowhere do we see it say that because the motive was right, the actions were excused. Nowhere do we say that because the motives were right, the actions are excused. So, I don't think we should excuse Mikhail's lie here. What I do think we should see here is that though lying is clearly condemned, I think we can know that while God was not pleased with Mikhail's lie, he did sovereignly work through it for the good of his people, and at that time, for the good of David. So I believe that God worked through Mikhail's lie. Now, I'm going to talk more about God working things out for the good of his people, but for now, I just want to be sure that you all know that I do not believe that we are ever justified in telling a lie. Ever. I don't believe that. I think it never pleases God when we tell a lie in any situation, no matter what our motives are. As I said, we are to be people of the truth, and that necessarily means that we are people who do not lie. So, back to our narrative. Saul still wants David dead, but after being helped by his best friend and then his wife, David is now on the run. And if he can't be in the palace and he can't be in his home, you're going to ask, well, where's he going to go? Well, he goes to Samuel, the kingmaker that we've all forgotten about by now. We haven't heard much about Samuel anymore. We're not going to hear much more about Samuel. But Samuel is at his home in Ramah, and David decides to go to where Samuel lives. And he goes and he tells him all about what is going on, which is to say, he tells him all about Saul and how he is trying to kill him, yet has not been successful. Together, Samuel and David go to Naoth, but word gets back to Saul, and he's not ready to give up. So he sends a group of his men to take David. And the words "take David" are intentional to remind us that unlike Jonathan, who is a giver and generous, remember Saul, he is a taker. He takes, and he takes some more. He takes what he wants, when he wants, from whoever he wants. That's how he functions. That's how he reigns and rules as a king. But in this case, he doesn't get to take what he wants because God has other plans, plans which involve David on the throne. So when Saul sends his first group of men to take David, they find Samuel and a group of prophets prophesying. And instead of taking David, the passage tells us Saul's men join in the prophesying. Now, I read a number of the commentators on what this prophesying was all about. I don't really think we need to spend a ton of time on that. At first I did, because at first, you know, when I read this, which I've read this before, I'm like, how can these guys be prophesying? But, I mean, I think the most basic and logical definition of prophesying here was that they were words from God for God. They were words from God for God, which is to say they were words that God put into their mouths that brought glory to God. Whatever they were, whatever it looked like, I don't really know. I don't really actually care. I think the point is if they were prophesying, then prophecy is words from God, and words from God would then glorify God. So I think that's what they were. But this is, I think, what is most important about this, not the definition of prophesying. I think what is most important is why they prophesied. They prophesied, as it says, because the Spirit of God came upon them. So clearly their prophesying was a result of the Spirit of God. It didn't matter whether these men wanted to prophesy or not. God determined that they would prophesy, and God then ensured that they prophesied. It didn't matter that these men were actually there on the order of King Saul to kill David, because God had other plans for David. And so instead of taking David, God causes Saul's men to prophesy instead. And I think this issue of what is most significant, that is that God ensures what he wants to happen does in fact happen, is further carried out as things progress in this situation. Because after the first group come and they don't take Saul, or they don't take David, they just start prophesying, then Saul says, let's send another group. And he sends another group, and the same thing happens with the second group. And then he says, I better send a third group. And he sends a third group. And the same thing happens with the third group. You got three group of men sent to take David, and instead they are all speaking words of God from God for the glory of God. Because of the Spirit of God. God ensured that this would happen. David and these men wanted David dead, and God wanted to be glorified through prophecy, and thus that is what happened. Now, at this point, I mean, Saul sent three group of men. It's kind of like, I'm going to have to come up with some other plan of action. So Saul decides that he's going to go as well. And as he's on his way, he doesn't even get there yet, and already he starts prophesying because the Spirit of God came upon him also. But not only does he prophesy, but once he gets to where David is, he also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay naked all that day and all that night. Thus it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? Now again, I think the emphasis here is on the Spirit of God that came upon Saul to make him prophesy. Saul wants to murder David, but instead of letting him do that, God instead forces Saul to prophesy. Saul has no say in the matter. Instead of committing a sin against God, God makes Saul speak words which glorify God. But then, as you notice, there's something else that happened with Saul that didn't happen with the men that he sent. And I think what is happening here is God is humbling Saul so that he removes his clothes, and thus he is now prophesying without his royal clothes on. He is humbled before God, something I think which is symbolic of the fact that Saul's reign as king is coming to an end. And when it does, David is going to ascend to the throne. You see, this was God's plan. God had anointed David to sit on the throne to lead his people, and thus God would ensure that that would happen. God would do whatever he deemed necessary to ensure that Saul would not kill David. The snake on the throne would not put an end to the king on the run, because God works all things together for the good of his people. And in this case, he did that in a number of ways, didn't he? First of all, he did it through the friendship and courage of Jonathan, who stood up to his father at the risk of his life. He also worked all things together for the good of his people through Michal and her deception and lies. Again, that does not excuse her for her sinful ways, but it does mean that God can take a wicked deed and use it for his good. Isn't that great news? That's great news. He also did it through his Spirit and his powerful work in Saul and the men he sent to take David. God worked everything out for the good of David, who was the focus of this text, as opposed to Saul, who was the focus of last week's text. That said, while the text was less about Saul and more about David and how he escaped, did you notice there was not one word in that text from David's mouth? The narrator doesn't record one thing that David said. Yeah, you can go, and you know, some of you can look, and you're looking through, there's got to be, no, there's not one word of David in this text. And I think the reason for this is because there's only one reason why David escaped Saul's murderous attempts. And that reason is God. God is the one working all throughout this text to work all things together for the good of David, because David loves God and was called according to his purpose, which meant that David would not die but would become the next king of Israel. So then one last time, I wonder, why would anyone want to be on the side of the serpent when you could instead be on God's side? You see, there are only two options in this world. You are on the serpent's side or you are on God's side. There is no third option. You either live for God or you live for Satan. So as an old hymn writer once asked, I ask, who is on the Lord's side? Who will serve the king? Who will be his helpers? Others lives to bring. Who will leave the world's side? Who will face the foe? Who is on the Lord's side? Who for him will go? If you are on the Lord's side, you love God and you are called according to his purpose, which is why after asking the above questions, the hymn writer says, by thy call of mercy, by thy grace divine,
We are on the Lord's side. Savior, we are thine.
So if you have repented of your sins and you have trusted in Jesus as your Lord, and if the Spirit has regenerated and indwelt you, then you are on the Lord's side. And thus, you ought to want to live faithfully for your King, the Lord Jesus. And if that is the case, if your desire here, if you are on the Lord's side and your desire is to live for your King, then there is a promise for you to cling to today. And it is that God works all things together for your good. And he will bring you through this life. And when it is over, he will keep your soul until he raises your body from the dead to live in the new heaven and earth with him and all his people forever and ever. So, like David would sit on the throne no matter what Saul and his men would do, we will be together in the end with God and his people in his kingdom, no matter what anyone does, including Satan himself. I mean, just think about it, no matter what anybody else does. People who would wish you harm. Friends that are not friends anymore. Family that don't wish to be family anymore. People in traffic who would seek to do you harm. Your prime minister who most certainly seeks to do you harm. And even Satan himself and all his demons. It makes no matter whatsoever. God will work everything for your good. And it is all because of Jesus. He was killed according to God's purposes. He was raised according to God's purposes. And he now reigns according to God's purposes. So if you are called according to God's purposes, cling to the promise that God works all things together for your good.